Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin with John Roerink, Emily Lawler, and Jacob Kanzler. Jacob, first of all, I got to congratulate you for expanding the MERS coverage into hockey this past week, getting us into the Bleacher Report. I was extremely impressed that now we're recognized nationally as a hockey coverage outlet.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you have a publication like the Bleacher Report, I mean, it means that we're on the new bounds here.
I've said for years we should add a hockey beat reporter.
Yeah, I mean, well, what's next now? Baseball?
To explain to our listeners, the Bleacher Report did a recap of an Olympic hockey game and sucked up one of my live tweets into it as some of their analysis, along with NHL.com and other hockey experts, if you will. So I somehow made it into the mix.
It was like half the article was tweets.
Well, I appreciate your tweets, because without the tweets, I wouldn't have known that Finland was spanking the United States on Saturday while I was at Jumping Jack.
Yeah, someone had to sit through that debacle, so...
I didn't sit through Michigan State, Michigan. I forgot, actually, they had a game at all. Well, let's later on in the podcast.
So
yeah, I know, exactly. Yes, exactly. Later on in the podcast, we were able to talk with John Nixon on his way out the door. He takes a position on the balanced budget amendment. We'll listen to what that is. Emily was able to talk with Mark Totten. What he would do with this DeBoer case, a very interesting take. We'll want to listen to that. But first of all, the big news in the morning, obviously, John Dingell is going to be announcing his retirement today in Southgate. Craig Mauger will be there covering it for us. John, were you surprised at this decision?
Not real surprised, because as we know, he's up there in years, and he's been frail. He's had some mobility issues that we've seen in the last couple of cycles, and he's had he's the dean of the house. I mean, nobody's served longer in the U.S. House than this guy, and eventually comes to an end.
And we've been hearing rumblings for about a week now that this could possibly happen, and I guess it's not a surprise when you think of a couple of events that happened. I think the first one was Debbie Dingell announcing she was not going to run for the U.S. Senate, and instead letting Gary Peters go. Mm-hmm. I think that was a sign to a lot of people that,
maybe she's got an in a congressional seat, which is well known to the Dingell name, or for the Dingell name. So
right, and so I think that was kind of like the first sign that maybe something was going on. I think another sign here that shows too is whether the Democrats have a realistic shot of taking the House next year. Because if Dingell were to return, he would only want to return, I'm sure, in a majority and as chairman of the Energy and Tech Committee. And as it looks right now, it looks like this is going to be, as things are shaping up right now, this looks to be more of a Republican year and a harder opportunity for majority. And for somebody like John Dingell, why bother?
And the timing is interesting, too. There's not a whole lot of time left between now and the filing deadline. It's kind of, if you're going to run a successful congressional campaign, I think John did a nice job of sort of pushing off the decision as long as he could and giving Debbie Dingell a good step forward by doing the announcement now.
And I think we would agree that Debbie Dingell is probably going to run for this seat. I'd be shocked if she didn't. And we've also been hearing in the legislature some rumblings about who would want to run on the legislative side. Emily Lawler, who do you think would you put top on that list?
You know, one name that keeps coming up is Rebecca Warren, who I think would be a strong candidate. She's a strong female, perhaps, to go up against Debbie Dingell. So.
And then also we've heard the name Doug Geis. It's going to be tough going up on that Dingell name there. Before John Dingell served, his old man was there for a few years, too. You got to go back to the 1930s before you can find somebody not named Dingell.
Been in that seat since 1933.
There. This is an expanded district, too, and it's a very high Democratic base at 66%. So obviously a Republican's not going to be a factor in this race, so it is going to be the Democratic primary that's going to make or break it. I think the key is going to be how much of that district, that how much can Ann Arbor carry in that, and that weighs on, I think, what Rebecca Warren does. And then how does that impact then the Senate Democratic caucus? Then all of a sudden that, you know, she's the chair of that caucus's campaign committee, then what happens? That there's a lot of dominoes that would fall if she were to decide to run.
Yeah, definitely. But, dominoes can fall good ways or bad ways for the Democrats. So I don't think that's necessarily a huge concern. But.
All right. Very good. Well, let's listen to your interview then with Mark Totten.
Mark Totten, good to have you on this week's podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Emily. It's great to be here.
So we wanted to ask you, news broke last week that Attorney General Bill Schuette had joined another lawsuit against Obamacare, bringing his total to 9. What's your reaction to that number?
You know, I think that this latest lawsuit that Bill Schuette has filed is just outrageous. Effectively, Bill Schuette has asked a federal court federal court of appeals in Washington, D.C., to raise taxes on Michigan families so that he can score one more political point with the far right of his party. The argument is something like this. He argues that states with federally created exchanges, such as what Michigan has, rather than state-created, don't qualify for federal tax credits. And let's be clear about what the impact of this is. If Schuette wins this case, there will be a 500,000 Michigan families who will face a $5,000 tax hike. To the state in total, that means a loss of about $2.5 billion annually to taxpayers here in the state of Michigan. And let's also be clear, we're talking about 100% federal dollars. This is not, these aren't state dollars. These are 100% federal dollars. We're a state that's already a donor state. And other states are going to continue to receive this tax release, even if Bill Schuette wins. And so we're going to be paying for it. But nobody in this state will be experiencing the benefits. And I think that's just, I just think that's wrong.
Are you concerned about just the sheer number? You know, there are 9 cases that he's either filed amicus briefs in or is a party of?
Well, I mean, if you look at a number of the other cases, not all, but most of them are focused on a particular issue. Most of them have to do with employers providing insurance coverage for contraceptives. And again, I think this is a clear point of disagreement between Bill Schuette and myself. Again, Schuette is seeking in this case to deny insurance coverage for contraceptives for potentially tens of thousands of women across our state. And, you know, I'll be the first to say that there are very significant First Amendment freedom of religion issues here. I am a person of faith myself, and I take those very seriously. If you look at the statute expressly exempts houses of worship from this issue, and I think that's right. The administration has also exempted religious institutions like private colleges or religious hospitals. They've found a way, in fact, I guess they've not exempted them, but they've found a way so that they are not directly funding it, and it's met with the approval of the American Catholic Hospitals Association. But what Bill Schuette is asking in this case is he's asking that any private employer based on the religious beliefs of the CEO should be able to deny insurance coverage for contraceptives for women. And I just think that's wrong. I think when we get that far out, where we're talking about tens of thousands of potentially employees being affected, I just think that's wrong. And I think this is one more attempt to try to score points with the far right of his political party.
Another area that Bill Schuette has been criticized for on the left, at least, is his involvement in LGBT cases, defending Michigan's constitutional amendment against gay marriage and also, you know, the law barring domestic partner benefits in some instances. Where are you on those issues?
So the case is coming up, important case that Bill Schuette is on one side of. It's going to come up before the court starting tomorrow. I think the bottom line is that, you know, actually, let me say something about this case. This is a couple, two nurses who have adopted individually, have adopted 3 highly special needs kids. These are kids who otherwise would likely still be sitting in a foster care system without parents. And what they're asking the court to do is give their kids the same legal rights that my wife and I enjoy with our kids, which includes the right, if one of those parents was to pass away, the right to be able to stay with their surviving parent. Bill Schuette's opposed this at every turn. He's argued that these folks, this couple, would be inferior parents. He'd rather these kids stay in a broken foster care system than grow up in the home of people who love them. And I just think that's wrong.
But could you have done anything else in the same position, considering that, you know, Michigan's constitution is barring what they're asking for?
Look, I believe, you know, that couples who make a lifetime commitment should be treated equally under the law. I believe at some point in our state that voters will extend the right to marry to all persons. I'll support that effort. I think that's the best way forward. As Attorney General, I take an oath of office to uphold both the federal and the state constitution. And in this particular case, The Supreme Court, I think, has made very clear where it's going on this. We have seen numerous federal courts, even in the last 4 months, which have struck down these laws. And I think my oath to uphold the federal Constitution in a case where the Supreme Court has very clearly laid out where it's going on this would require me to take a different position than Bill Schuette. I will say that I believe it would be important for this case to be represented. I would appoint an independent special assistant attorney general to defend the law. But I'd argue that in accordance with my oath, that law violates the federal Constitution. And at the end of the day, again, this is about the well-being of kids in our state. And I think it's wrong for Bill Schuette to really just try to keep these kids in a broken foster care system so that he can please the far right of his party.
All right, I've got one more question and I'll let you go. Recently there's been rumblings about Detroit attorney Godfrey Dillard possibly running for attorney general as well. How concerned are you about securing a spot on the ticket?
You know, there's been conversations rumblings really since I got in about various people jumping into this effort. And I've just been focused on working as hard as I can, both to hold Bill Schuette accountable and to build the campaign that's going to be necessary to win this race. At the end of the day, the decision about who the party's candidate is going to be is a decision for the delegates. It's not a decision for me, and I'm going to stay focused on working as hard as I can to win in November.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Good to be on the show, Emily.
John Nixon is going to be leaving state government on Friday for a job as the top bean counter for the University of Utah. And before he left, John, we were able to get a couple minutes with him, and let's listen to that interview. Joining us now for the podcast, John Nixon, budget director. Thanks for joining us, John, on your fourth to last day here in the office.
Hey, my pleasure, Kyle.
All right, the first question I wanted to ask you, what is your biggest fear leaving this job about what's going to happen to the budget here in Michigan?
You know, I don't have a lot of fears. I think that we've established a good framework for the budget. You look at where we are, we've got all the main financial components built in a good budget. We're paying down our liabilities. We're putting money in the rainy day fund. We're taking care of those long-term liabilities that we have, and we're making strategic investments. You know, 3 years ago, in 2011, when we set out, we knew that we had a very difficult situation in front of us. We had $1.5 billion structural deficit, meaning we were spending $1.5 billion more a year than we were bringing in. We had $65 billion and growing in uncapped liabilities in our pension system for both the state employees and the school employees. We had an education system that was propped up with hundreds of millions of dollars of federal money, federal stimulus money, and we were in a financial crisis. Well, we hit the reset button, Kyle, and now we're in a position where, you know, 3 years later, we just presented our fourth structurally balanced budget. It's a solid budget, and those principles are in place. We have a great new budget director coming in, John Roberts. He's been part of the budget deliberations the last few years. He understands it. We also have a great governor who's a CPA who understands financial accountability, and he's not going to let things go awry on this budget.
The biggest threat to the state budget since Snyder took over is the federal impact on the budget. What's your thoughts about the balanced budget amendment? And how would you correct the federal fiscal situation?
The federal issue is a very, very complex issue. And obviously, I'm very supportive of them addressing their budget deficits. I mean, we just can't continue to run the amount of deficits that they've been running. You look at the way we did it in Michigan. When we came in, we had that deficit. Although we were robbing Peter to pay Paul. We had a big early out in the retirement system that wound up costing us hundreds of millions of dollars in future years. You know, those are the types of things the federal government's doing. You know, they do need to come up with a plan on bringing that budget back into balance, and they need to do so by prioritizing spending, just like we did. We didn't come in year one and do across-the-board budget cuts. We came in and actually looked. The governor and I looked at all the different areas of spending, and we prioritized it and said, what can we afford to do? What can't we afford to do? The federal government's got to do the same thing. I mean, it's true. The biggest risk for state governments is the federal government. I mean, how unfortunate is that? You know, if they can't get their debt ceiling increased, if they, you know, whatever else they might do, the dysfunction that's happening there, you know, it has a big impact on the state. So what we've done in Michigan is we've made sure that we're operating in a structurally sufficient way. We're putting money in the rainy day fund. So if something does happen at the federal level, we have time to react.
Is we're in the driver's budget seat. Amendment the way to fix that, though?
Yeah, I think that they have to work towards a balanced budget amendment. I think that it, you know, obviously, you know, they can't eliminate huge, huge deficits overnight, but they've got to get to a balanced budget. I think they should get to a balanced budget. There are those who, you know, there are many, many implications when it comes to the federal government balancing its budget. I mean, there's so much debt that's expected in the system, in the pensions and the retirement systems. But certainly what they're doing now is not in the best interest of the country. I do think that they've got to work towards balancing their budget. So, you know, I think that, you know, any way that we can do that and have that dialogue, I think it'll be helpful long term.
What about the arguments that if you have a balanced budget amendment on the federal government, that there won't be any opportunity for any kind of long term infrastructure type expenditures, that you're putting too big of a restriction on the federal government, that it has to spend more than it takes in sometimes?
You know, I think there are certain times that it does. I mean, when the economy goes into a recession, that's when the government needs to spend, obviously, you know, and you look at the economic models. But the long and the short of it is, and I don't know exactly what the right answer is. I've been working on Michigan's budget. I haven't been working on the federal budget. But what we need to do is we need to start to rein in the spending back there or down there. We need to make sure that they are prioritizing spending. And, you know, the government can't be all things to all people. And so, you know, I think you bring up some good points, Kyle, and those are things that have to be addressed as they weigh those different things. But at the end of the day, I do think that that something's got to be done in Washington.
How do you, as far as prioritizing the spending down there, what do you think the problem has been? Has it been politics? Has it just been politics on a grand scale? Or what do you think the problem is, a systematic thing?
Well, obviously, it's very difficult. I mean, the way Congress is set up, it's very difficult to make cuts. I mean, because whenever you're making cuts, you're taking funding away from people. And I think you look at how it was in Michigan, I think Michiganders were to a point where they realized something had to happen. I think all Michiganders were. They were tired of being dead last. They were tired of being bottom of the barrel. It was a real crisis that the state was in. I mean, we had had, you know, government shutdowns. We had had all sorts of stuff. The employees were in a very unstable environment. The companies, you know, Michigan Business Tax was very unstable for them. It was a very unpredictable and unstable environment. And it was ripe for change. I mean, I think you saw that with the election. Governor Snyder came in. You came in with a new House of Representatives, Republican House. And certainly we felt like the mandate was there for the public to move forward and make some changes, and we have. And now that the economy's coming back, we've had to make some tough decisions. And now that the economy's coming back, I think people are pleased. You know, I've been amazed that since I said I was leaving, I'm getting notes from teachers, I'm getting notes from the public.
Everybody loves you now,
every
right?
Day. Well, it's not that they love me, but there are a lot of people come in. I mean, they bring in a stack of cards from the public, people I don't even know, who say, hey, thank you for the work you've done in helping put our state back together.
Really?
Yeah, it's been pretty rewarding. I mean, it's been pretty cool.
Boy, but it makes you want to say that you would have resigned sooner. You would have gotten even more, maybe.
Well, or I would have stayed longer.
What are you going to miss most about this job?
I think you.
That's so nice. Appreciate you saying that.
In all seriousness, I have enjoyed our relationship. No, I am. I've enjoyed our relationship over the years. But, you know, I think there are a lot of positive things happening here in Michigan. I think Michigan's finest days are ahead of us. And I think it's going to be part. I really enjoy working with Governor Snyder. You know, I've worked with some very good governors. You know, I've worked for Governor Leavitt, who was Secretary of HHS. I worked for Governor Huntsman, who ran for president and was the ambassador in China. Worked for Governor Herbert. And they all have great, unique attributes. But Governor Snyder, when it comes to the fiscal policy and understanding the finances, you know, for a budget director, it's just been a dream. We've been able to sit down, and I pull out my long-term liability chart, and he understands it. And he not only understands it, but he problem solves it. You know, the guy's a very smart guy. And so I'll very much miss working with him and the team. The team here has been very, very good. Not the senior staff team, you know, Bill Rustem and Dennis Muchmore and Dick Posthumus. This kind of the dream team that I've been fortunate to be a part of. But not only that, my immediate team, you know, Kurt Weiss, my assistant Connie Minix, just my immediate team here within the department and the budget office. They've just been wonderful, wonderful people, and wonderful people to work with, very professional. Now, all of my staff, you know, all 2,700 of them, I'm going to miss them a lot.
Do you think Governor Snyder's got presidential material?
I think the country definitely needs somebody like Snyder. Mm-hmm. I think somebody who can go in there in a very data-driven way and start looking at things. I think somebody like Governor Snyder. I'm not going to comment on whether he runs or not. I mean, obviously, I think the country needs somebody like Governor Snyder. I mean, and I've been around this game a long time. I do understand the budget issues and budgeting within the government, and Governor Snyder's a phenomenal guy.
Very good. John Nixon, State Budget Director. It's going to be sorry to see you go. Unfortunately, this is your last podcast unless you come back.
Yeah.
Which could always be a possibility, right?
You never know. I'll be vacationing here a lot. Michigan's my new second home. It's a beautiful state. Everybody should be proud of this wonderful state, you know, and if my extended family lived here and, you know, my grandpa could watch my son play football on Friday nights out here, you know, probably would have been a different decision, Kyle. But this has been a very difficult decision. But as you asked me before, these jobs don't come open very often, especially in Salt Lake City, Utah, where, you know, my extended family is, my home is. But again, Michigan, I'll be back. I want to make sure that I have connections here to Michigan and maintain the relationships and friendships I've developed.
Awesome. Glad to hear it. All right. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to John Nixon and Kurt Weiss, and also Mark Totten for taking some time with us. Also John, Emily, and Jacob. And then also, I've got to thank the Michigan Press Association for sending the podcast out far and wide. Oh, and also a special thanks to Tom Kasperson this week for hooking us up with some UP treats that some in our office won't eat, but...
I had no idea that the UP was known for its chocolate.
Well, what do you mean with Mackinac Island?
Oh, I guess that is in the UP.
Yeah, St. Ignace, yeah.
Forget that.
I don't know, is Mackinac Island in the UP?
It is. They have the area code for the...
Is that right?
Yeah, it's 906 something.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But do they count themselves as in the UP? This is a good question.
That is a good question.
I mean, they're kind of their own thing. They don't have cars.
What is that kind of... What, anyway? Oh, my God. Well, until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.